minutes are approved. We're waiting for Representative Dunkey, so hopefully it will be only a couple minutes.
Madam Chair, do you want me to do reading from my book?
Harry, sorry.
Paid by the bell.
Representative.
Paid us for Myrtle.
You're welcome.
Representative Falk, would you move House File 793?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 793 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a department bill that you and I are offering, and I'd ask the department to come up and do their bill. Here they come.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Sheffield with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and Ag Development and Financial Assistance Division. I'd like to speak to the proposed bill. The has three major parts, the first being with the Rural Finance Authority to change the loan participation limits. The Rural Finance Authority has been a strong program, continues to meet the needs of young farmers, particularly as we look at beginning farmers, livestock producers, and farmers facing financial adversity. However, agriculture is changing, the economics of that keep changing. The current loan limit that we have, we are starting to run up against that more often and would like to raise that slightly to meet the needs with the raising land prices and the rising cost to do business within agriculture. The second part of the proposal is the Shared Savings Loan Program, also known as the Sustainable Agriculture Loan Program. That is a revolving fund that we have that has been at $15,000 for a number of years. And again, with the changing scope and size of agriculture, we wanted to increase that loan limit up to $40,000 as a direct loan that we offer through that program. And finally, the third part of the bill is with the Farm Security Loan Program. That was a program that predated the Rural Finance Authority. It's what the state used to do when they were working with beginning farmers. The Rural Finance Authority actually superseded that as a better program in that it is a safer program for the state dollars that still meets the needs of agriculture and young farmers that are out there. The rules for that particular program were already deleted in 2006, and this just takes out the statutory language, so we're cleaning up legislation in essence and abolishing that program. We currently have no outstanding loans with that program, and the last time we did make a loan in that program was 1986.
Are there any questions? comments? Representative Faulk.
One quick question. How much is the beginning farmer program, loan program, how much is the increase on that? I didn't see it on the handout.
Madam Chair. And Representative, the beginning farm program is also called the basic loan program and the seller assistance, so my mistake that way. We think of it in terms of beginning farmers, but it's the basic loan one is the one that works with the banks. The seller assisted one is the one that works through somebody who's selling a contract for deed to offer the same terms and opportunities.
Are there any other questions? Comments? Are there testifiers in the audience? Mr. Rappert?
Madam Chair, John Appitz with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I'm representing Farm Credit Services here. You may see me again a little later this afternoon. But that said, I think I've spoken with a number of you, and you all know that this is the very sort of thing that Farm Credit Services endorses and has been encouraging. This is a very good bill. We commend the author and the department for bringing it over. Makes things a whole lot more efficient. And I think it would be much more workable for folks in the countryside. So congratulations for pulling this together. And it has the full support of Farm Credit Services. I'll just throw in, and if there was a guaranteed opportunity someday, that would be something else to think about. So I'll leave that commercial behind.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Oh. Representative Faulk.
I renew my motion that House File 793 be recommended to pass and be reaffirmed to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Faulk, would you move HF 900?
Madam Chair, I sure will. I move House Bill 900 be recommended to pass and referred to Committee on Finance.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a DE1 amendment I'd like to put on as an author's amendment, get the bill in the shape. If Representative Morrill would move that.
Madam Chair, I move the DE1 amendment.
Are there any questions of the amendment? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I'll explain the DE1 amendment now, which is the bill. And then I know you have a whole list of testifiers. So just simply, and you're going to hear the reasoning behind the bill here from testifiers in a minute, but subdivision one, this deals with railroads and pesticide application, which is why it's here in our division, your division, and we'd like it over in finance, too, in case there's a cost to this for the department. The subdivision two talks about any railroad company with more than 50 employees basically needs to have a licensed non-commercial applicator in their fold, so that and again this language was all actually developed by the department so that they have a contact person at the railroads who they can send materials to or posters or training materials or whatever they have someone that is their contact person that is kind of knowledgeable in what the department does in pesticides. So we thought along with the department that was a good idea. Subdivision three also provides that the commissioner annually should make contact with the railroad company, which again, in their field inspectors and pesticide folks, that should not be a problem. They need to make that contact and provide materials, provide training materials, or conduct training for them, which is carried out actually in Section B there. Railroads typically have safety training once a month, but once a year, we would like that common carrier railroad to conduct employee safety training on pesticides. And again, these are sprayed around yards and up and down tracks and where employees work. And so it's become an issue out there with them. And so All we're asking is that for 15 or 20 minutes or an hour or whatever the company decides that there should be training. However, we're still working on that language. I'll be honest with you moving forward. We want to make sure that training isn't just handing them a card that says, here's pesticide rules, read it at home. You know, we want something more substantial than that, and I don't think that will be a problem with the rail companies. And then the real, I think, substantive piece beyond that is Subdivision 5, which basically is what you should be doing anyway, and no one should disagree to this. Again, the Department of Agriculture is the folks that oversee pesticide law in the state and inspect when there's off-label occurrences or misapplications. And all we're doing is requiring the railroad company, or in most cases, the company they contract with to do their spraying, that if there's an off-label or a misuse of the pesticide, someone gets sprayed, you spray someplace where you shouldn't, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that within 4 hours they report that to the department. And that's, I think, as I sort through this, has been some of the problem is there have been incidences, and because the employees didn't know any better and the foreman didn't know any better and the railroads probably weren't aware, there is a place to report this. There are people that do the inspection, and if there was wrongdoing, there are fines levied. So we already have that in place. We're just making sure it's clear that that has to be done. And then I guess I skipped Subdivision 4. Again, it's common sense, but again, for the workers out there, to not apply pesticide to occupied or unoccupied equipment, basically. And these are restricted use pesticides, so we're not talking about wasp spray that you buy to spray a wasp nest on a engine, or you know, bug traps or something you might have in some of these vehicles. So that's the bill, and I guess, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer questions at this point, but perhaps you want to go through some of the testifiers first to get a better understanding of the issues, and then we can delve into it from there.
Thank you. Save your name for the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike DeRosa. I am a State Legislative Director for the Brotherhood of Maintenance Away Employees, Division of the Teamsters. I represent track workers in the state of Minnesota. Every spring, railroads employ commercial applicators to spray herbicides on railroad tracks and right-of-ways. These chemicals kill the weeds and brush that could cause roadbed and safety issues. Every herbicide used on the railroad has an MSDS sheet. The MSDS sheet lists the potential side effects that exposure to these herbicides can cause. Most of these herbicides can cause eye and skin irritation, some severe, and can cause respiratory problems if inhaled. There have been several recent incidents on railroads involving herbicide applications. Rail workers have been sprayed and exposed to chemicals immediately after the application. In one case, a worker suffered a severe allergic reaction. We believe that this bill can help stop these incidents if the railroads will inform and educate their employees. We've been working on this bill for 3 years. We've had several discussions with the Ag Department and the railroads. We've made several compromises, including omitting the notice of when the spraying will take place. We have three other testifiers that will discuss incidents that occurred on their railroads. Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there any questions? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, a common carrier railroad company that operates in the state must conduct annual employee pesticide safety training. Now, do all employees have to participate in that training?
I would say we could limit it to the employees that are going to be affected. So office workers obviously would not be affected, but trainmen, track workers, signal department, engineers, those would be the people that would be affected.
And Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, if I can answer too, as our research staff is taking notes too as we go here, because this literally I got this amendment done today. So there are some things, I think you bring up a good point there, that it should be the people that are going to be exposed to those restricted use pesticides, the kind of harshest weed killers we're using, as we know, on the railroad right of ways to knock that stuff down. So,
Yes, Madam Chair, that was the point I was trying to make, that it should be those people who are affected, who are actually working with the pesticides, and not all employees.
Madam Chair, again, not working with the pesticides, but working where those pesticides are applied. Right.
Any other questions? Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the language in 1.5 and 1.6, requiring that these employees be Minnesota resident employees, and I'm not sure anybody's really going to know the answer to this right offhand, but are we going to skip a railroad or two that has 60 employees because a dozen of them live across the border someplace?
Madam Chair, are you talking about the first subdivision?
Subdivision 2. A railroad company with more than 50 Minnesota resident employees.
Well, subdivision 2. Okay, yeah. Basically, why we put that in there, and yes, it wouldn't be employees in any other states at this point. I would hope the companies would do it if they're crossing borders. I don't know what that's... The reason we put it in, we have some short lines that maybe have a dozen or five employees, and we don't want to require them to have to find one of those five employees to get a pesticide license from the department. So that's really why it's in. We hadn't concentrated on any... And maybe Mr. DeRosa knows that would even occur, where there'd be cross-border problems of finding someone who, it's a worker in Minnesota.
I think on the big railroads that's not a problem, but maybe on the some of the short lines that is potential, but I'm not sure, I guess. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Junkie, what's the purpose of 50 employees or more? Why not require the ones that have fewer employees?
Well, Madam Chair, with the cookies and the juice, I did that, and maybe Mr. Appick can answer that when he gets up, because that was a compromise with him representing the short lines, and he had that concern. So we didn't have any employees to begin with until today, and we put it at 50. So there is no reason, and you're thinking through it like you should, Representative Hamilton.
Any other questions? If not, Representative Drozdowski? Okay, thanks. We can continue then. Bill Doherty? Say your name for the committee.
My name is William Jordy. I'm with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, Madam Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay, Madam Chairman, I'm the Vice Chairman with the Unified System Division of the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. I represent the track workers, bridge and building employees, machine operators, and welders working on the Union Pacific Railroad, as well as several other small railroad companies. I began my career on the former Chicago Great Western Railroad right here in St. Paul in June 1968. In my current capacity, I keep my seniority on several classifications in the Maintenance of Way Department on the Union Pacific, while serving approximately 3,700 members in the Unified System Division. Now, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees was founded 122 years ago, and one of the primary objectives of our founders was to ensure that track workers have a safe place to work. Today, you'll hear from representatives of the railroad industry. Mr. Apitz and his colleagues will no doubt inform you of the railroad's practices and programs that already provide protection to employees who are exposed to herbicides and pesticide applications in the workplace. They believe that additional legislation is unnecessary and that their client railroads already take care to protect the employees and the environment. They may cite facts that workers have MSDS books available to them at the headquarters work locations to provide information about the hazardous materials which they encounter on the job. The Union Pacific has made these resource books available to the employees. However, these MSDS books are worthless unless the railroads provide advance notice to the employees of the specific chemicals they're going to be coming in contact with and that they'll be exposed to. Today, the Union Pacific Railroad is not providing that information to its employees. This is not just my personal opinion. I have brought with me over 20 written statements from employees on the Union Pacific Railroad regarding the failure of the railroad to provide them with information necessary to ensure that they have a safe work environment. I won't burden the committee with my reading on any of the employee statements. However, I would like to point out that there is a common thread that runs through all of their statements. One, the Union Pacific Railroad does not provide advance notice to its employees that they'll be exposed to herbicide or pesticide spraying. Two is that the employees are not provided detailed advance information about the chemicals that they'll be exposed to. MSDS information is not made available. When employees do request information from their supervisors about the chemicals they encounter as a result of the herbicide or pesticide application, they're often ignored or dismissed with a, "Oh, don't worry about it, it's harmless, it won't hurt you." Or, on occasion, the supervisor may truthfully state that he doesn't know what it is. The railroad's failure or refusal to provide the employees with advance notice and detailed information about the chemicals they will contact places all of the employees in an unsafe work environment. I've had the opportunity to be before this committee on the same issue in prior legislative session, and I would again like to share with this committee two instances with which I'm particularly familiar. The first instance occurred a few years ago. I was returning home when I noticed several railroad vehicles parked at the Roseport Depot. Roseport is an industrial area on the Union Pacific Railroad that's located near the Flint Hills Refinery in Rosemont, Minnesota. I stopped at the depot thinking that our maintenance away forces might be working late. When I entered the depot, one of the switch crew informed me that the crew had pushed through a switch and were all going to be tested. While waiting for the drug test, one of the trainmen asked the trainmaster, who's his boss, "What's all the white stuff all over the tracks and the switches?" The trainmaster answered him. He said, "They must have sprayed down here today." The trainman then asked him, "Well, what did they spray with?" The trainmaster looked at him and said, "Don't worry about it, it's safe. Just don't lick the switch handles." I had asked the trainmaster if there was an MSDS notice about the chemicals that had been sprayed. He said he didn't know anything about any MSDS sheets. I then looked through the bulletin board postings on the desks and on the entrance doors to see if there were any advisories, you know, that had been posted about chemical application in the area. There are no notices or advisories for, you know, provided to the employees. The second incident took place several years ago in Milwaukee. Our bridge and building crew, one of our crews that I represent, was reporting to their tool car to start the day's work. As the gang exited their truck, they noticed a white substance all over the tool car. One of the members on the gang became ill as he got out of the truck. That employee was having a reaction to the chemical that had been sprayed in the area the prior evening. The B&B gang had received no advance notice that the area was going to be sprayed. No one was aware of the identity of the chemical that was causing the member's illness. Prompt action by his fellow workers resulted in the employee getting emergency medical treatment. The ill employee required hospitalization, and he experienced severe blistering of his exposed skin and required several blood transfusions to rid his system of the chemical which he'd been exposed to. It was discovered that the vapors remaining from the chemical sprayed the prior evening were the cause of the employee's near deadly illness. It must be noted that these two incidents did take place several years ago. Has the railroad industry, or specifically the Union Pacific Railroad, taken measures to ensure that such attitudes and injuries as these two examples are addressed so similar incidents will not occur again? I invite the committee to take time to read my attached statements provided by the Union Pacific Railroad employees. I firmly believe that the atmosphere has not changed. Employees want a safe work environment, and it is not being provided when it comes to herbicide and pesticide application on the Union Pacific property. The railroad's refusal to meet the safety needs of its employees clearly demonstrates the need for legislation to protect railroad workers and the public. In conclusion, I'd like to thank the Madam Chairman and the members of the committee for the opportunity to address you here today.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And is it Jordy?
Yes, sir.
Jordy? Mr. Jordy, I know in agriculture, I'm in agriculture, we have to have MFDS sheets at access for all the employees at all times. And in your testimony, you said you don't have that access. I believe it's law. Are railroads exempt from having that available to their employees?
They are not exempt. As I stated, sir, the railroad has provided MSDS books. It looks like a Sears catalog.
Right.
It has a listing of every chemical in there, from greases and fuels to cleaners, anything that the employees may be exposed to. The problem we face is when an employee comes in the morning and there's residue over everything, he doesn't know what it is. Is it a cleaning solution? Is it film for a soap film? Is it a herbicide? What's been sprayed? They're never advised. They go cold into these work environments.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Jordy, that's the clarification I was trying to get to. I thought I heard in your testimony that you didn't have access to the MSDS, but that's not the case. It's the case of not knowing for sure what it is that they've encountered that day, correct?
That is correct, right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Jordy? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Dean Bell.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to address this committee as well. I did provide a statement, but I don't know if I got a copy, but need time for that. But all right. Well, my name is Gene Bell. I've been an employee of Two Line Railroad, who's parent company of CP Rail, since September 10th of 1979. So I've been out there for about 30 years. I've worked on the gangs and stuff that Mr. Jordy had identified. Also, I've held different positions. I started out as a laborer, then machine operator, assistant foreman. And the last position I worked on the railroad was as a production tamper operator. I had a territory of about 117 miles that I had to cover in the state of Minnesota, mostly west of Minneapolis here. I also held numerous positions in the BMWED IBT union. In 92, I was elected as the local chairman of Lodge 893 and held that position until November of 01. In September of 02, I was elected as the general chairman of the Two Line System Division and held that position until August of last year, which we then merged with the Milwaukee System Federation and became the Midwest System Federation. I now serve as the assistant general chairman under Mark Wimmer. this letter is written in support of the proposed statute regulating pesticide application on the railroad right-of-way. I have been involved with gangs, I've been foreman on gangs and stuff, and I have encountered the spray myself. You know, it's a white residue on the ties and whatnot, and you really don't know what it is until you ask your supervisor, and then they say they sprayed. And again, I agree with Mr. Jordy there. He hit it on the head. We don't have MSDS sheets provided. Again, there's a book provided at annual training, which takes place every spring. Matter of fact, training is being provided to employees next week in Medina on different operating procedures and whatnot. So the railroad company does hold annual training for its employees out on the track every season. Also, I would like to relate a story similar to what happened on the on Two Line property back on July 18th of 2006. Two Line Railroad hired an outside contractor to spray for weeds and vegetation along the right-of-way west of Minneapolis in the vicinity of Loretto and Hamel. The contracted applicator came through this area in a vehicle that the employees call a spray train. Now, that I haven't seen, but it's a unit that goes down the track and sprays, and they normally have this unit go out, you know, after the employees have been done working, they spray at night. But anyway, the contracted applicant came through this area and sprayed for weeds at around 10:30 in the p.m. The next morning, when the crew was traveling from Loretto to Hamel, Minnesota, traveling east with on-track equipment, The crew traveled through this area with the on-track equipment at a high rate of speed for about 5 or 6 miles. After the applicator applied the herbicide, it rained. So as the crew was traveling the next morning, the men and equipment traveled through this raid area, and thus it created a mist. It just brought up the rain and whatnot, created a mist with this mixture of water and pesticides. The crew consisted of about 39 machines and some 40 men. As the crew traveled through this area, and since it had rained the previous evening, a mist was created that the men and equipment traveled through. Some of these employees stated that they could smell an odor in the air as they traveled through. Later that day, some of the men complained of a burning sensation in their throat and eyes. And some complained that whatever skin was exposed, they could feel a burning and itching sensation. A few developed rash-like symptoms, and some said that they could taste the foul. It was bitter. It was a bitter taste in the air as they traveled through. The crew was very upset and wanted to know why they had these symptoms. After many complaints from employees about these symptoms, the foreman called the supervisor who had responsibility for this crew. And what I'd like to note there, that there are supervisors that will head up a number of crews. Each crew has a foreman. So the supervisor was called home previous to when the applicator came through and sprayed on account of a family emergency. The supervisor was informed of the weed spraying, but unfortunately, the supervisor had forgotten to inform the foreman of the crew. After the foreman was informed that the area had been sprayed, he asked what kind of chemicals had been used. No one had information on that, nor was there any MSDS sheets available. This incident was reported to OSHA, and Michael Helms, safety investigator for OSHA of Minnesota, investigated this incident. Although no citations were issued, OSHA did recommend some changes in the protocol that Two-Line utilizes, such as 48 hours notice to employees who may come in contact with the applicated area. Should not spray designated work areas. MSDS sheets should be provided. Employees should be provided proper protective apparel and improved communication. The union, upon its own investigation, found out that well over 90% of the time, employees who would be in contact with the applicated areas were not informed of the weed control application. And even if they were informed, some of the information was not correct. The contracted applicator had a tight schedule and would not deviate from it even when informed not to spray in certain areas. The employees also had a hard time recognizing areas that were sprayed, as there was little or no indication of what areas were sprayed. They stated that they might see white slippery spots on the ties and plates or on the switch stands. No one should have to, offer an opinion here, I feel that no one should have to work in these kind of conditions. The crew should have been informed, and the applicators should not have been allowed to spray in work zones. Employees should have been supplied with the proper protective apparel and most definitely been provided MSDS sheets on the chemicals that will be applied. Legislation must be provided so that this practice cannot be continued. It is evident that the railroads care little for their employee safety, as this is habitual behavior. I ask the representative to consider this letter when making a decision. If you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to.
Are there any questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bell, I have a couple uncles that work for the railroad as well, Uncle Bubba and Uncle Tuffy, so that's my background, my friend.
Good.
Just a couple things. You talked about the railroads holding annual training.
Yes.
Is that directed by OSHA? Is that driven by law, those annual trainings that they hold on your behalf? You said something about out on the track they hold these trainings.
They don't really hold it. They do some training out on the track when it comes specifically towards equipment, but every spring they hold a training for employees and they review safety rules that the railroads have in place. It's annual training that the railroads do for FRA type of safety recommendations and whatnot. So it is mandatory that they hold these training seminars.
Representative Matt Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bell, you also talked about not having access to MSDS sheets. And again, my understanding is that is the law. You have to have that. And when you said, when you contacted OSHA and brought up your concerns, or when your fellow employees did, you said no citations were issued and recommendations from OSHA were recommended back to the employer. did the employer then follow OSHA's recommendations?
Yes, after they had sprayed, I shouldn't say after this, but after this incident came to light and was brought up, the DS sheets were provided. Again, like at that annual training that they hold every spring, again, they have that catalog with all that stuff, but we don't know what's out there until we end up encountering it, and then we have to ask questions. So it's more, you know, it's more reactive than proactive. But also after that incident, we did get a weed spraying schedule the following year. In 07, I had one that they provided to us, and that was the first time ever. And it gave the whole schedule of the time and the areas of when these applicators were going to be coming through.
Representative Hamilton?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bell, I'm just trying to get a good understanding of this, to understand what's in law already, whether it's required by OSHA. And if OSHA's making requirements, I strongly believe that the employer needs to follow those, or there could be some repercussions. And I want to know particularly what your employer did once those recommendations came to light. And you said that the sheets were then provided, and there was a schedule of spraying was provided then after that, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
For 08. But then now it's 09, and we haven't seen a schedule or anything else yet. So.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question. What changes do you make after you've been notified? I mean, how does a notification of spraying affect the behavior of the workers?
You
know, once they get noticed, then they know, you know, what chemicals would be applied. They get noticed, they know that a weed applicator or a weed sprayer is coming through. They know that the chemicals are going to be provided. They can then look it up in their catalog, because it's in there. You know, once they know that application is there, they also know the time that the applicator came through. And if they would have to work in that area, you know, they would have the proper protective apparel. You know, they wouldn't just, you know, if there's some light residue on switch stands and stuff, they know that applicator went through, they can then say, well, that was, you know, the application of the weed spraying, and therefore we need to check our CSG and see what we got here. So.
Representative Erdahl?
Thanks, Madam Chair. So, essentially, if they know ahead of time, they may wear different clothing, maybe have gloves or something like that.
Correct.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think this question may actually be for Representative Junkie, but it arises out of this testimony. It's about lines 1.7, 1.8. These lines, Representative Junkie, refer to railroad companies to contract with commercial applicator. And I understand that, is, for example, in the situation we just heard of, this was an outside applicator who came in and did the spraying. I'm wondering, when a railroad hires an outside commercial applicator, why does the railroad still need to have a licensed employee applicator?
Madam Chair and Representative Morrow, the licensed employee applicator is not to apply, but it's to provide a conduit for information with the department. It was the department's suggestion that this would be an easier way to keep in contact with the railroads, because they have the list of licensed applicators. They provide annually training materials, posters, other things on Minnesota pesticide laws and other things. They would then have a point person to send that into in the railroad. It's not difficult, obviously, to get some. I used to be a licensed applicator when I worked for ConAgra, even though I didn't apply chemical, but I did it just because then I had the knowledge of the training and what was going on, and I had a contact then with the department.
Representative Morrow?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tucker, maybe you could just expand just a little bit for those of us who don't know. What does it take to become a licensed non-commercial applicator? What will these railroads have to do?
I'm getting to the point where I'm going to bring Mr. Bozicki down here, because he was the one that wrote this language. So.
Thank you.
Say your name for the committee, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Bezicki. I'm the Director of Pesticide and Fertilizer Management. And Madam Chair, Representative, what it takes to be a non-commercial applicator is to pay a fee, of course, and which is $50 and a $75 accuracy, and to take a closed book exam and to pass that exam with 70%, and well, obviously, and then to fill out the forms properly and provide information that the department would need, you know, location, you know, the contact information. And, Madam Chair, perhaps just to expand on Representative Junkie's comments, when Representative Junkie discussed this with us, I took it back to staff, raised the issue as to, you know, this is what Representative Junkie is wrestling with, and we saw some language. And I posed the question, what's the best way for us to stay in contact and have a knowledgeable person that we deal with? And the answer is actually to license. That's what we do. We license 3,400 non-commercial applicators in the state. It is not unusual in our experience, whether it's the DNR or other agencies, to do as Representative Junkie just described to the committee, to have people who are knowledgeable and go through the licensing procedure to be knowledgeable about the regulations and the use of pesticides, even if they're not personally applying. That's not an unusual circumstance. So we put that out as a way that we could have consistent communication, provide the information that we do through via newsletters and so forth, have a contact should something arise. So that was how we had responded, and this would be a licensure that we have that currently is used by other organizations for these types of purposes.
Representative Kraskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bezicki, I was just looking at the statute. 18B.37 talks about records, and I guess for the committee's indulgence here too, the that part of the statute directs commercial applicators and those that apply along right-of-ways to provide a copy of the records, and right-of-ways are allowed to have no more than 5 pages in their records, and that category in wood preservatives are limited to 5, and all other categories are limited to 1 page. And they're also required to give a copy of those records to the customer. So I was trying to follow the different testimony we have, but undoubtedly, if the law was followed correctly, it appears to me, and may you please help us out here, that the records, including date, time, brand of the pesticide, number of units treated, temperature, wind speed, location, name and address of the customer, and a variety of other details are supposed to, according to statute, be included in the record. So those should be available, and it shouldn't be just a big, thick MSDS book that we're looking at. It should be a specific record that talks about that application for commercially applied pesticides at these right-of-way locations on the railroad that they should have, and the customer should have a copy of that. And I guess part of my question, Mr. Bezicki, is, I mean, most of these, as I recall from my days working with Extension Service, also include maps, and I would expect that right-of-way applications applied commercially, those records probably would include maps as well. If you could comment on those, I'd appreciate it.
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. Those application records must be maintained by the applicator, and a copy must be provided to the customer. And usually they do have maps. That is correct. So those should be available. I apologize. I don't recall exactly what the time period is in which that is. Perhaps that's in the statute, but those are applied, and so they are kept available. And I believe they're provided to at the time of application. Now, when you're dealing with an application that may cover many miles, those records may be deposited, and I would have to actually ask our investigators when we go search out those situations, when we do an investigation, who actually has that record, because on a railroad track, it may be in their station house or their headquarters. I'm familiar with that, Madam Chair.
Representative Dostoevsky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Bezicki, as we look at the licensing requirements under Subdivision 2 of the bill, would it not make sense that the department could send a correspondence to those people who are customers of those commercial applicators who are applying to the rights of way of these railroads, and not have to have that requirement in there for an additional person to be potentially required to be certainly trained and pay the fee and maybe potentially be hired by the railroad in order to do that?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we obviously could obtain the address locations of the railroad companies. We could do that. Again, our response was this is something that fits into our system of licensure and what other organizations do on occasion where they want to keep somebody who is not only familiar with a particular application, but also the rules, the changing legislation, statutes, any rules that we might develop, best management practice, whatever it is, get information out. That way we have a conduit. So that's more what we were thinking about as a contact point and an information point where we routinely deal with thousands of folks in different categories for different purposes. So in short, Madam Chair, it's the equivocal look. Yes, we could maintain a list of addresses, but that would not necessarily guarantee that we have a knowledgeable person there that is in constant communication with us. We certainly could add that, but it fits very nicely into the non-commercial category that we currently have.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dave Brown.
Madam Chair, I think members of the committee, my name is David Brown. I'm a locomotive engineer with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. I've been an employee of the Burlington Northern for the last 38 years. I've had many instances of being around them spraying from the times in the 70s where they had a passenger car that was retrofitted to spray chemicals behind the car on the tracks, and we were, as a conductor and the brakeman, I was inside with that car, and it was a very thick white powder over everything. At no time during that period of time in the railroad were we ever notified of any type of circumstances that may be jeopardize our health. To bring it forward, fast forward to this year, I was a locomotive engineer on the Hinkley Local, which goes to Hinkley, Minnesota, and does industries, switching out industries along the way. Coming to work, at no time were we informed that any type of chemical spraying was going to be occurring on the Hinkley subdivision. We went out there, and the first stop was just outside of Coon Creek. There's a beer warehouse out there. We were switching out there for approximately about an hour and a half. There was a strong chemical smell in the air. There was white substance along the track and on the switch stand. I had a very young crew that had never experienced weed spraying. One fellow was munching out of his pocket a snack after he had already touched the switch and threw it and working around this white substance, ingesting this chemical before I had a chance to inform him that he probably should wash his hands before eating. We didn't have any facilities on board the locomotive to wash our hands when we're around this chemical. It would have been very easy for the railroads to have posted a MSDS for us prior to going out on the line and informing us that there was spraying going to be occurring so that we could have properly prepared ourselves. I find that legislation needs to be accomplished here to assure a safe workplace for the employees on the railroad in the state. And to bring it short and sweet, knowledge is survival. And I feel that a close contact with the Ag Department and with the railroads to work closely with the training of us on what we would be facing and protect ourselves would be more than adequate. Thank you for my this opportunity to speak before this esteemed committee.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you.
And Madam Chair, as he's leaving, I just want to say Mr. Brown's got the job every one of us wanted at one time in our life.
Brian Husted?
Yeah, I have just one thing for the committee, just so you know how the railroad operates a little bit. Before a crew can go down to the track, you have to receive general orders. I can't just go out on the track haphazardly. I receive general orders.
You probably should go into the mic. Thank you.
I just wanted to help. He just brought it to my attention when Dave was up. But before a crew can go out on the track, a train crew or a work crew, we are provided a fax assembly of information called general orders. And they give that every morning. They fast mode at 4 or 5 in the morning, sometimes 2-3 times a day. Normally at noon you get another advisor. So this is, I just wanted to let you know how the railroad communicates with employees before they go out onto the track and have authority to go out there. So all this information is provided. I feel that it would not be, you know, it comes through what, at least on CP Railroad Sewer Line, it comes through the C office, a general communication office, and then they transmit that across the whole property 2-3 times a day. So, but anyway, I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Thank you
for your time again.
Is Brian Husted here? Oh, there he is.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Philip Qualley, State Legislative Director for the United Transportation Union. Mr. Husted cannot be here today, a result of the weather in western Minnesota. I would just like to say on behalf of the railroad workers in the United Transportation Union, we strongly support this legislation and ask you to vote in favor of passage. Bottom line is, year after year, we have private contractors or weed sprayers showing up on the property. We don't know that they're showing up. We get territory sprayed, and we've had cases, incidents where people are being, managers are saying, you have 20 minutes for the stuff to dry, but you know, get back out there and keep production levels up. We have situations where people are having some reactions to the film that's left on the steel, the switches, the track appurtenances. And finally, last year in Wilmer, Minnesota, in May, we had a situation where a worker was actually covered, sprayed with the applicator going through the yard. And unfortunately, that testimony is not available today, but would have been the testimony of Mr. Husted with a signed affidavit. Thank you very much. Again, we appreciate your support of this bill. And thank you to the chief author for bringing it forward, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. John Abbott?
Madam Chair, my name is John Appett. I'm with the law firm of Messer and Kramer. Like you need a new chair.
This is interesting.
And I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. With me is Dan Rickle, who's the president of Northern Lines Rail and the president of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And we appreciate this opportunity to discuss this issue. I'm also going to ask the page if we couldn't share a couple of things, because the chairman did raise a couple of questions which I hope we can respond to. Ireland, let's start with this and this, and then you can go that straight. Let's just start with sort of a statement here. Why would railroads spray their employees? They wouldn't
and the dose. And some of the testimony you hear kind of makes it sound like the policy of the railroads to spray their employees. Accidents do happen. Accidents happen in a lot of situations. We're all aware of that. I just want to kind of get on the record that railroads don't, and they wouldn't spray their employees. They take a lot of steps to make sure that that does not happen, and I want to go into a few of those details. But some of the stuff we're going to give you, just to take a quick look at here, are some background information that I can first go to the chairman's question about, or I think it was Mr. Hamilton's question about the size of railroads. You'll have in front of you a map starting out, and the map is a map of the railroads in the state of Minnesota. There's kind of three kinds of railroads in the state of Minnesota, and I'll call them big, medium, and small. This is for working purposes. We call them class 1, 2, and 3s. And the large railroads, the class 1s, the ones you know as the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, the Union Pacific, the Canadian Pacific, the CP, and the CN. Medium-sized ones, you've all heard of the DM&E, Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern, and that's a couple of others, the ICE, that's the corn line that goes down to the south. And then there's the small railroads, the real small ones that involve shorter line pieces of territory, anywhere from 5 miles if you're the Progressive Rail down in Lakeville, to a couple of miles if you're the Red River Valley up in the northwest part of the state, to maybe 95 miles if you're the Twin Cities and Western Railroad that runs across the middle of the state of Minnesota. Part of the, we have all different sizes, and I won't go into the history of how they were all created, but one of the sheets that I gave you was a map of those different railroads. You can take a peek at where the railroads run. The second sheet that you're getting is a sheet that kind of, that I had put together that explains the, lays out the numbers of miles of track and the numbers of employees involved with each of these railroads. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. And the third sheet is an overview sheet of the railroads generally. Let me start out by saying that all the railroads in the state of Minnesota use commercial applications. I mean, that's the way it's done today. It wasn't always the case. Railroads at times used their own Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way employees to apply pesticides in the past or other sorts of employees. But generally speaking, railroads have commercial applicators who apply the pesticides along the railroad tracks to keep the weeds down. The purpose for that is obvious. It's safety. You don't want a lot of weeds going along the side of your tracks, and the reason you take the weeds out is to make sure that you have a safe track and a track that can be seen along. One of the reasons we hire commercial applicators is to have somebody who's knowledgeable in the law. Representative Drzewkowski just kind of went through the law, and the conversation with Mr. Bisecki would indicate that there is some complexity to this area, rightfully so, because you're dealing with dangerous chemicals, and that's why you involve people like this. Earlier today, I had a conversation with a gentleman by the name of Brent Polinchek, who Representative Hamilton knows quite well. Brent Polinchek runs a railroad down in his district. I think it is the Minnesota Southern, has about 42 miles down there and 7 employees. Brent used to apply his own pesticide. He doesn't anymore because it's just too complicated, and getting a license was kind of a complicated thing to do as well. The issue was he couldn't get the license in Laverne. He had to travel elsewhere. If you know Mr. Polinchek, you know that's some bit of a difficulty for him, despite the fact that he runs the railroad down there. Suffice it to say, he dropped the license. He's got a commercial applicator. He applies it on Saturdays when nobody's around. Nobody gets exposed. And he hopes it rains before Monday so that, in fact, the chemical seeps into the ground and it does wash off the switch fan. The point of this little bit of conversation is to suggest to you that level that Representative Junkie put into the bill was something we suggested by virtue of saying, you know, if you require these small railroads to get a license, and Mr. Bisecki suggested that was so that we could share information with them, these small railroads basically have applicators hired to do this, and they're all aware if they've got 7, 14, 16, 20 employees, they're all aware when their pesticides are going to be applied.
I think Representative Junkie kind of heard my plight and said, well, let's just exclude those folks from the licensing requirement. They probably have enough practical common sense knowledge not to get this applied to themselves, and I think that's the reason, and that's the reason I put this little chart together. So who does this apply to? This applies to basically, if you take it from the Amtrak North on the sheet, Minnesota Railroad, the Amtrak North, this is who the law is going to apply to here. And that's the Minnesota Commercial Railroad, that's the DM&E, the CNCP, UP, and the BNSF, who have the vast majority of employees in the state. Now, one of my other clients is the Union Pacific Railroad, who you heard testimony just a few minutes ago, apparently doesn't give notice, to its employees of any of this activity. Well, you know, I've heard that for the last 3 years, that the Union Pacific was kind of the culprit involved here, and that they were failing to give any sort of indication to their employees that there was going to be pesticide application on the properties that they're working on. So I said, is that the case? To the regional manager who operates the area here, I said, is that the case? The operations division manager who's in the St. Paul area, the Minnesota area. I said, is that the case to the government relations representative was out of Chicago? And they said, no, that's not the case. What you're receiving is an advance notice that the Union Pacific puts out every year that it, through its commercial pesticide applicator, the D'Angelo brothers, and they do this nationally in 13 different states, of the fact that there's going to be the spraying of pesticides, and very specific pesticides, if you look a little bit ways down, as is required by the railroad and otherwise, of the kinds of pesticides that are going to be applied. I think earlier one of the gentlemen noticed that there hasn't been this notice that's gone out yet for 2009. It happened in 2008. You can see it did there. It happened in 2009. Well, in fact, the reason he hasn't seen it yet is because it hasn't gone out yet. It's going to go out in April. You can see that's when the effective date is. That's the first notice that goes out. And as this bill was originally put together, it was about notice. These employees want to know that the application is going to be applied. They want the railroads to give notice. We've changed that requirement. But they want there to be notice of the fact that there's going to be pesticide applied. That's the first notice. The next notice comes, as the gentleman indicated, and it's supposed to be the case, the next notice comes a couple weeks in advance of the application. The maps are available, et cetera, et cetera. And then the tertiary notice comes in those morning briefings, when employees are told that the pesticide is going to be applied. Okay, so then what does the applicator do? What the applicator does is he applies the pesticide along the line. If he comes upon a crew that's working on the line, they stop spraying the pesticide. They go around the crew, and they spray beyond the crew. They don't spray the crew. As I said, railroads don't, and they won't, spray their crews. So that's basically how the procedure works. Notice is given. Employees are aware of it. If they're paying attention, they have plenty of opportunity to find out what this stuff is. In the instance of the UP, I asked, what if you know that you've got an employee who's sensitive to this stuff? And the gentleman who's responsible for this said, and he can't be here, and I apologize for that today. He said, we get them out of there. We know we're going to spray. We get them out of the area. We assign them to a different location because we know he's had a reaction in the past. So they don't want these people exposed, their employees exposed to these sorts of problems. I've labored this a little bit, Madam Chair, but I've labored it because we've been talking about this for 3 years. And what you have before you, and I'm very respectful of what Representative Junkie has done and continues to attempt to do, and kind of hone this thing down to put into statute some requirements that probably are taking place already. My simple point being, we're doing it, we don't need to be told to do it. And if you'd like some more details about how it's done on a particular railroad like Dan, we've got 7 employees up in the St. Paul area. He can show you on the map. We can go into that as well. But I think there's a question, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Epitz, you were hitting this a little bit, but essentially, if this passed, what would railroads do differently than what they are doing now?
Mr. Chairman, what the railroads would probably do is somebody on the railroad would be required, as I read the amendment that was adopted, somebody on the railroad in a railroad that's over 50 Minnesota residents. And the question was asked about how about if you got a railroad that has only a couple residents but is a large railroad. The Red River Valley and Western up in northwestern Minnesota is an example of that. They got two Minnesota residents and 60, or two Minnesota employees and 60 employees altogether. But the railroad would be required to identify somebody who lives in Minnesota to go take the test, to go do the study, take the test, continue the education, and have that test, have that, I believe, that license renewed annually, if I'm correct, Mr. Busecki, have that license renewed annually. I think Mr. Drzkowski might be able to answer that question better than I. He used to teach this particular subject, as I understand.
Any other questions?
Sure.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Appitz, you know, we heard the testimony, and I think everybody that's affiliated with this has the same goal in mind with a safe workplace, what one gentleman stated earlier, and that knowledge is vital. A few of the things that are disturbing, and I just want to revisit those, is on the MSDS. There was a couple testimony, and that's why I asked the question. Number one, it's law. And I want you to address these, representing companies, if you will. The MSDS, employees having access to that. The other thing, there was a comment about not having proper access to a hand wash, and so being able to wash the hands. So I'm just asking about the hand wash, eye wash, any first aid kits or bloodborne pathogens, that employees have access to that as well. And then when we're talking about training, we have a series of training. I read on this notice you said something about a weed spray video. And so walk me through that as well. Employees have access. Are they exposed to that? Is it mandatory? Just walk me through those three things, sure, if you would, please.
And I'm going to walk through them backwards, and I'm going to pass where I might have a colleague like Mr. Sweeney who could help out a little bit with the BNSF activity in this regard. The video, I was hoping to get a copy of the video, not that you enjoy seeing it, but so that you could see an actual copy of the video. It's a training video that lasts, I think it's about 20 or 30 minutes. Every employee is required to see that video, and if they haven't seen it before the beginning of the spraying season, as you can see on that notice, they're to tell their manager of that, and then they'll have the opportunity to take a look at it. I'd like to get my hands on it, and I'm happy to show it to you if that occurs, but that's the way the training actually takes place. I believe what it demonstrates is what a chemical is, how it's applied, if you have a reaction, what you're supposed to do, what these chemicals can do to certain people, and to be sensitized to that. With regard to the proper access to hand washing, eye washing, etc., I'm here to suggest that may or may not be readily available. There is a warning at the bottom of that which says if you have been exposed to this, that you should wash your hands. You shouldn't smoke. You shouldn't eat without having cleaned your hands off. And if you're handling apertures, signals, etc., that would have a residue on, you should cover your hands up and keep them from, not put your hands on that stuff without some gloves on. The applicator that I talked to was the Angela Brothers, so he keeps a supply of sort of latex gloves on hand that if workers want to use them, they can get access to them. I have to confess, I'm not completely sure how that takes place. And then you asked about the MSDS. I think all you have to do is ask for information about this. And you see the chemicals that are listed on that particular notice. If you don't want to go walk through the book, you can kind of like get on the computer and look it up and get that information. I might refer to, again, Mr. Drzkowski, who probably has taught some of this, but I think that information is fairly readily available over the Internet if you want to get it. Maybe everybody doesn't have a computer, but I think we can get access to it. Mr. Sweeney might be able to help with that, or Mr. Rickle.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just submit to Mr. Apis that it appears, at least in the case of this railroad, that there's the sheets or the facts or whatever, however this gets to employees. They've got the very short summary here. They've got the pesticide application record that came from the commercial applicator. And if they really want to go deeper into the physiological and biological effects of exposure to any of those herbicides, they can go in the, into the MSDS book, which it sounds like is available many times too. So they've got three different levels of information, maybe four if you count the video. It seems like we're doing a pretty good job of providing the opportunity for people to see what is being done there. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for Mr. Rickel or for Mr. Appice, I believe. I'm focusing on the short lines, so focus on the regional rail. And if I heard the answer to Representative Erdahl's question correctly, what aren't you doing now and what do you object to kind of question, I'd like to focus back on lines 1.7, 1.8 of the short lines of the regional rails, if you will. How many of them are applying pesticides on their own and how many are hiring a commercial applicator?
None and all. None are applying it themselves and all of them have commercial applicators.
Thank you.
Representative, excuse me, Mr. Appice, I have a question. Effective date, April 21 to 08 until December 31, is that the notice?
Madam Chair, that's the first notice that goes out. That's the early notice at the beginning of the year. That's the one that they send out generally. You'll see, I think it indicates throughout the Minnesota district. And then the specific spraying on, or the specific notices spraying on, are provided subsequent to the daily briefings or in advance. But that's the general notice that goes out with the list of chemicals that may be applied. Gives everybody an advance notice by 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, well, almost a whole year.
No, ma'am, that's the last year. The one for
right, I understand that. But that's what you say. What it says is April 21, 2008 and December. And for me, that looks like the notice.
That's correct, ma'am. That's what it's effective, Madam Chair. That's what it's effective. It applies for that period of time. These are the chemicals that will be sprayed. These are the areas that will be sprayed. These are the things you should do if there's a spraying in that area. And that's the general notice that goes out at the beginning of the year. After that, the specific notices, I think, as the gentleman earlier indicated, I apologize, forgot his name, to come out in the, you know, the daily brief. So today we're going to apply on the track on the area in this section. Be aware of that fact and take proper precautions.
And Mr. Appice, we're hearing though that they're not getting that. So how do we fix that? You know, I mean, really, it isn't. It probably is. It's the railroad. It's the person that. Or whatever it is, so that's probably where the problem is, more than the railroad. But obviously, they're not getting it. That's the problem. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think what we're hearing in some of the testimony is that it is a two-way street. That some of this is being provided, and for whatever reason, it's not being read. Am I wrong with that observation as well? That not only is the responsibility lies with the employer to make sure that stuff like this is individuals are trained, they have access to all this, then it also comes back to responsibility of an employee to be able to mm-hmm. take the initiative to get a hold of some of this as well or to understand it. Is that an accurate statement?
If I could address the committee, my name is Dan Rickel. I'm the president of the Northern Line Railway. We are a very small railroad, one of the littler ones in the state. But I do have experience on Class 1 railroads as well. I have a history with the Chicago Northwestern Union Pacific, a mid-sized short line railroad that operates in the state, the Twin Cities Western Railroad. I was the general manager of operations with them before taking the position with Northern Lines Railway. And the requirements of a crew when they come on duty are to review the notifications that have been posted. The crews, and this goes for platforms, this goes for short lines, this goes for mid-sized regionals as well. There is a responsibility of employees that come on duty to make sure that they're current with the rules that are in effect for the day, for the general track bulletins or general orders. As each Class 1 railroad has kind of a different mechanism for providing the information, but there is a responsibility for the employee to make sure that they're conversant with the rules and that they adhere to the rules as well. So the information that's provided has to be reviewed. And from a short line perspective, our, what I love lovingly refer to as our mom and pop railroad of 7 employees and 25 miles of track, we provide a general order that lists all of the chemicals that are going to be sprayed. And to start from scratch, we do hire a contractor. We don't have anybody in-house that's qualified or licensed to provide the application service. But we do provide a general order that lists all the chemicals that are going to be sprayed. We provide MSDSGs for employees. We do daily job briefings when the sprayer's in the neighborhood or in the area that's going to be kind of bring them up to speed as to where the applicator is going to be working for the day. So, you know, we do, and you're right, everybody wants a safe railroad operation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's contract people or whether it's managers, but the goal of all of us is to provide a safe work environment for our employees.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a sidebar conversation I'd like to share with you. You know, myself and the Chair were just discussing this. The employer has a responsibility to make sure that this is posted. The employee has a responsibility to make sure that they read it. And the question that we had is, one, if the employees are receiving that information, and two, if not, why or what can they do to make sure that they are receiving it? Is it already in place? Are there methods in place in the event they're not being notified on whatever the case may be, in this particular case, the spray-in? But is there... are there things in place that the employee can call through a chain of command or whatever the case may be to acquire the information that you are posting in the event they don't receive it?
So from our perspective on the short line, yeah, it's very easy because we're a tight-knit crew. I'm sure that there are safety hotlines, local managers from the Class 1 railroads, and I don't know if Brian, you want to speak to that, but there are mechanisms that if in doubt, ask. That's always been pretty much a relevant philosophy. If you don't understand something, if you're unsure of something, ask your immediate supervisor, and if you can't provide the information, you're always entitled to bubble it up.
So does that mean that every day you have to look and see if there's going to be pesticides?
Well, if the information is provided on a daily basis, and again, I'm not really conversant with the current union-specific practice, but if it comes out in your each train crew or each maintenance day employee that comes on duty does receive essentially a packet of information. For instance, in Santa Fe, they use the NSF, they use what's called a general track bulletin, a GCD. And in that packet of information are pretty much your governs your authority for movement and provides any kind of notifications. And Brian, jumped in front.
Representative.
Well, ma'am, Chair, I was just going to suggest that we let Mr. Sweeney explain what Burlington Northern does, and one of the folks that couldn't be here was a worker who actually got sprayed, and you know, I think they've made the correction or whatever, but Wilmer's got a big yard. We have 200 people that work in a yard in Wilmer, and or out of that station, and I guess I'd like to have Mr. Sweeney explain the procedures out there, how would a worker coming in like Representative Hamilton, you know, we've heard testimony that they walk out onto the site and they see the light. Well, obviously, there's something that's not connecting there. You know, they're in at 5 in the morning. I know how I am at 5 in the morning starting work, and I've worked in factories and other situations. I understand going through the lunchroom, there's stuff posted. I get that. But they're not grabbing the information. They're not aware of it. And more importantly, they're not educated once they get out there to say, oh, my God, you know, like the engineer said, don't eat your sandwich after touching that stuff. Or don't, you know. So, again, Mr. Sweeney can maybe provide, I think Burlington Northern's doing a fairly good job on this, I'll say that up front, and But we have a lot of railroads in the state, and they're maybe getting sucked in a little bit here, too. But Mr. Sweeney.
Say your name for the committee, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Sweeney. I am legislative counselor for BNSF Railway in St. Paul. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd like to open by reiterating what Mr. Rappett said. If somebody actually gets sprayed, it's not because this bill hasn't been passed. It's because somebody screwed up. Somebody violated existing regulations. Somebody violated existing company policy and regulations as well. Somebody made a big mistake somewhere along the line. That's why it happened. It isn't because we have kind of a devil-may-care attitude to these chemicals. Our practice is, number one, we have annual training for all employees who would come under what's known as the Book of Rules. That's basically the train crews, the maintenance of way crews, signal maintainers, the people who would be out on the property all have to go through annual the hazard communication program, which covers how to deal with and act when you are around all kinds of hazardous materials, not just herbicides. When it comes to the herbicides themselves or pesticides, we have a vegetation control policy, which I won't give you all 18 pages of it, but it does call for notification and education of employees. It was in fact upgraded late last year, the notification section, and it calls for the commercial applicator, and it's all commercial application on our system except for spot weed control where somebody grabs a bottle of Roundup or something like that, and in fact we have rules in place for that. But the general applications is contracted out. When the spray applicator shows up on the property, he's supposed to, number one, hold a job safety briefing with the roadmaster. That's the person who's in charge of the track maintenance workers, and provide the MSDS sheet to the roadmaster. The sheets are also provided to the train masters. Those are the people who supervise the train crews. Job safety briefings will be held with the pilots. These are the people who escort the applicators on our property, the contractors. They'll drive the vehicle that rides on the track, precedes them, and another one following them, typically to protect them from train movements and so on. Basically escort them down the track. So they hold job safety briefings with the employees. These job safety briefings, the contractors to participate in them. In the terminal locations, the roadmaster will notify the local transportation people so that everybody who is reasonably expected to be working in the affected area is notified in advance there is going to be spraying taking place. And they are told the MSDS sheets are provided. MSDS sheets are to be posted. They are to be at the safety briefing. Also, the spray vehicle is to have the MSDS sheets under this policy. So the information is there. So we pretty much, I think, through company policy and practice, as well as existing regulation with herbicides, have this subject area covered. We do have some concerns about the legislation. The big question is this resident. One Minnesota resident employee must have a license. We're not, Frank, I've got a question whether you can legally require a Minnesota resident, but it seems to be requiring a license rather than just, you know, provide a name or something that's a point of contact. We have, my company operates in 28 states. People get transferred. In fact, our current head of vegetation control for the entire system used to be a roadmaster in Minneapolis. If we have a licensed person and that person gets transferred, we're not sure why it's even necessary. So we have a problem with that. We do a lot of the pesticide safety training now. We do it on an annual basis. We do it the day we get notification out shortly before. The spraying is done. We do in our safety briefings. We have the contractor involved in it. So we really don't see the need for this legislation. Again, if there's a problem out there where somebody is exposed to this, if somebody is being sprayed, it's because somebody has made a mistake. They have violated existing regulation, existing law, existing company policy. We bend over backwards to try to avoid these types of situations. They are very rare. They should not be happening at all. I will grant that, but it isn't because we aren't paying any attention to the subject. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more step. We talked about the existing regulations. We talked about the company policies. We talked about, in the event this happened, somebody screwed up. If the employee, let's just go one more step. Number one, if the manager does not do their job in order to properly train the employee or properly post the policies or whatever the case may be, what type of performance improvement plans or whatever policies do you have in place to train that manager? And two, in the event someone screws up like this, what steps can the employee take within the company? If you can just touch on that one more time.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, if anybody in our operating department in any management position will tell you that the policy book is the Bible. If they violate a rule, particularly if there is a violation that results in an injury, they will hear about it. The supervisor is certainly going to hear about it. There will be a very uncomfortable situation. We take this seriously. There will be, I am sure there will be notices put out, bulletins, reminders put out that this is the policy, you will abide by it. If the contractor violates the policy and doesn't provide the accurate information or whatever, the contractor is going to hear about it and there will be steps taken there as well. But we do take this seriously.
Representative Hamilton.
And in the event an employee is disgruntled with their manager, are there steps, are there other people that the employee can call?
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. We have confidential recording systems as well as, you know, if you want to report it up the line, you can, but we also provide confidential reporting systems, protect the anonymity of the employee if they feel that there is a need to report some rules or safety violation and they don't want to put their name up, that is possible for them to do.
And Madam Chair, just one last thing. What I'm trying to do is just draw a connection here to see where the disconnect is. If we have the laws or the regulations in place currently, if we have company policies in place, which you state that you have, if there are ways that we can address managers' performance, of course that's not government, that's in your realm of things, and if there's another outlet for employees to go to in the event there's a resolution disputed that is not being taken care of by their managers, that they have another route as well, then I have to question, why do we need this legislation? That's where I'm going with this.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that certainly I heard one reference earlier in earlier testimony to the way things that were done in the 70s and so on. And yeah, I think not just the railroad industry, but just about everybody was a lot looser with this type of thing. You don't even have to go back that far. In recent years, with increased regulation, increased scrutiny, I think these incidents certainly have diminished. Do mistakes and accidents take place? Yes, they do, unfortunately. I don't think, though, that we have today a widespread situation of this. I think that when you look at about 4,600 miles of track being sprayed every year, an accident will happen now and then. That's not acceptable, but I don't think that that there is evidence that there's a widespread problem that's calling out for additional legislation or regulation. I think each company certainly can and should make sure that they are communicating this information with their employees, to their employees, and doing what they can to make sure that it's understood.
Senator Stonkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're getting close to ending here, so I want to make a few comments, and I appreciate the railroad sitting here, and I really appreciate all the folks that have testified. And I want to, I've learned stuff today too, like I think the whole committee has. Until I heard the testimony on both sides, it's always hard to sort through this in your office as you're writing and trying to compose legislation. I guess my comments would be, again, this is coming over to my committee because I want to make sure there's cost involved for the department for this. We're taking care of them. And I am going to be, I can guarantee you, redoing some of this, or at least talking to people about redoing some of it. I think Points were made today that I still want to stress, that I think everyone's okay with limiting the bill application to those that are exposed to these chemicals. We're not talking about office workers or IT people or others. And that's, I think, common knowledge, and we're okay with that. We're going to certainly take a look at the, I think Mr. Sweeney brought it up well, you know, whether we need to have what the department wants, someone licensed or not. Again, that was their deal, and I respect them for giving it a shot, but clearly the railroads and the workers did not bring that to us. The department brought that to us as a way. And we'll try and figure out, you're right, we want a contact person that we could provide materials and information and other things to. On subdivision 3, that language, and again, I just saw this amendment today, as you can see by the timestamp on it. What really we're looking for in there is to, again, make sure that safety training occurs, to make sure that it's not just a card handed someone or, frankly, go watch a video, but that it's a training with a real person that can answer questions back and forth, that can actually say, you know, if you see white stuff on the tracks, you have to do something different. I mean, that it's real good training. We do, my point in here was to allow the railroad company to do that. If BN is doing that, and I do believe, by the way, BN is doing a good job on this, as opposed to maybe some of the others in the state at this point. But if they're already doing it and are satisfied with their training and are meeting what we expect them to do, that all we want them to do in interaction with the department is report to them the day and the place that the training occurred, and that knowledge was shared through that contact person, so now the department can keep records for us that those trainings are happening annually, that it wasn't just a movie or a piece of paper handed to them, say, here's your training on pesticides this year. And, you know, so they can establish some rapport and understand that those things are being accomplished. And I don't think that's a burden on anyone. And we're asking the department then to have an annual colloquy or contact with the railroads to affirm that this is happening, or to do the training on their behalf. They can do that. They do that all the time. We have field inspectors and investigators out there. They'll be more than happy to stop into a half-hour training and do a live one-on-one update on pesticides. That's what our state departments are for. Again, I don't think there's any dispute on the restricted use applied to equipment. That's, again, it's common sense. We're just repeating it. The big part of this bill is the misuse reporting. If everything goes well and everything works, you're right. No one wants to get sprayed. Obviously, you know, in larger yards, I suspect, and again, the person wasn't here, I'm only surmising this. This is my little bubble above my head, that a worker got in the Wilmer yard somehow and was out there, whether he should have been or not, or she should have been or not, when they were spraying the actual yard. So it was an opportunity for, you know, them to stop, remove their equipment, go through with the spray, put their equipment back on, realize it's sprayed, but this worker was probably working around cars or equipment or something, yard, and it came through on another track when he got sprayed, so he didn't have that opportunity. That's something that shouldn't have happened. Agreed. And that's what this is really addressing in this paragraph, and what the railroad worker's after. That guy in Wilmer or in Western Minnesota and the railroad company and the foreman and the supervisor and I don't even know all the names of all these people on the railroad, did not know to call the Department of Agriculture and report it. It was a misuse. Someone got sprayed or someone's getting sick and breaking out in rashes. Who do you report that to? And that's probably the most important part of this bill, is requiring the railroad, through their foreman, through their supervisory role, others, to report within 4 hours so we can get the investigator on site, sort through it, just like the OSHA folks did, but really OSHA isn't the pesticide regulators, they are, and get a report made, and if wrongdoing was done, according to 18B07, there is punishment, and there are fines. But we have experts and professionals that do that, so the real gist of this bill is getting them on site whenever anything happens. That's why they're there, that's what we do, and I don't think the railroads or anyone else would disagree with that. And so I'm willing to continue to work with everyone in this room to make sure that we have a safe workplace for railroad workers and that they're trained and understand what they're working with, because I do think they're in a unique situation. As we all know, railroads are very unique, not only in law, but probably in work situations and the atmosphere that they're in. So
I respect both sides on this issue. I think we're getting closer to having something that folks will agree with. I think that there is some need at this point to continue to work and put something into statute that'll make everyone comfortable that this is being addressed. And again, I apologize to any railroads that are doing this and above and beyond, but there's some that aren't, or apparently aren't. And we've heard that testimony. So he said, she said, I get that. But that means there's a problem out there. This wouldn't be here at all if there weren't things happening, because the employees don't bring this stuff forward willy-nilly either. And so I think it goes both ways on that aspect, too. So, again, I'd ask for your support. I think it's going to be a good common sense thing. Good government all the time, Representative Hamilton, like you always say, and echoing Representative David, and I'd ask for your support.
Representative Dostowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your discussion, Representative Junkie. As I look at the bill, subdivisions 4 and 5, I think are probably the valuable parts of the bill. 2 and 3, I think we're getting redundant. The department believes that they've got some value they can bring in. I'm very impressed with what I heard from Mr. Sweeney and what is the largest railroad carrier in the state. Unbelievable job you guys do, and I mean, if the other railroads are doing anything like that, I just hate to see us as bring government in and try to maybe go overboard here. I guess I would just go one step further than what Representative Hamilton went earlier. He talked about, you know, the genesis towards bringing information down. The last step is this, and it is actually having the employee carry out what is learned in the video, or carry out what is read on the board, or carry out what is told to them by the supervisor in the training or other places. We aren't going to get everybody to do it, no matter if Mr. Bazooki comes out and has a one-on-one conversation with everybody within 2 minutes before them going on their job. You are not going to get everyone to put their gloves on when they turn that switch handle. I learned that through my work with the private pesticide applicator training. People are still people. Allegedly, somebody came drunk to school yesterday as a teacher. Those things happen. We aren't going to be able to control everybody's behavior, no matter how hard we work. I'm fearful if we look at subdivisions 2 and 3, Representative, that we're going a little bit too far. But I do like subdivisions 4 and 5. Thank you.
Representative Mr. Mansky.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Junkie consumed all my time. I'll hold my questions for his committee.
Okay. Representative Faust, will you move?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 900 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Adjourned.